Chapter 8, Childhood, Abuse, and the Escape from Religion.
There is in every village a torch, the teacher, and an extinguisher, the clergyman. Victor Hugo.
Physical and mental abuse. Once, in the question time after a lecture in Dublin, I was asked what I thought about the widely publicised cases of sexual abuse by Catholic priests in Ireland. I replied that horrible as sexual abuse no doubt was, the damage was arguably less than the long-term psychological damage inflicted by bringing the child up Catholic in the first place. It was an off-the-cuff remark made in the heat of the moment, and I was surprised that it earned a round of enthusiastic applause from that Irish audience, composed admittedly of Dublin intellectuals and presumably not representative of the country at large. But I was reminded of the incident later when I received a letter from an American woman in her 40s who had been brought up Roman Catholic. At the age of 7, she told me, two unpleasant things had happened to her. She was sexually abused by her parish priest in his car, and around the same time a little school friend of hers, who had tragically died, went to hell because she was a Protestant, or so my correspondent had been led to believe by the then official doctrine of her parents' church. Her view as a mature adult was that of these two examples of Roman Catholic child abuse, the one physical and the other mental, the second was by far the worst. She wrote,
"Being fondled by the priest simply left the impression, from the mind of a 7-year-old, as yucky, while the memory of my friend going to hell was one of cold, immeasurable fear. I never lost sleep because of the priest, but I spent many a night being terrified that the people I loved would go to hell. It gave me nightmares."
Admittedly, the sexual fondling she suffered in the priest's car was relatively mild compared with, say, the pain and disgust of a sodomized altar boy. And nowadays the Catholic Church is said not to make so much of hell as it once did. But the example shows that it is at least possible for psychological abuse of children to outclass physical. It is said that Alfred Hitchcock, the great cinematic specialist in the art of frightening people, was once driving through Switzerland when he suddenly pointed out of the car window and said,
"That is the most frightening sight I have ever seen."
It was a priest in conversation with a little boy, his hand on the boy's shoulder. Hitchcock leaned out of the car window and shouted,
"Run, little boy, run for your life."
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. The adage is true as long as you don't really believe the words. But if your whole upbringing and everything you've ever been told by parents, teachers, and priests has led you to believe, really believe, utterly and completely, that sinners burn in hell, or some other obnoxious article of doctrine such as that a woman is the property of her husband, it is entirely plausible that words could have a more long-lasting and damaging effect than deeds. I'm persuaded that the phrase child abuse is no exaggeration when used to describe what teachers and priests are doing to children whom they encourage to believe in something like the punishment of unshriven mortal sins in an eternal hell. In the television documentary Root of All Evil, to which I've already referred, I interviewed a number of religious leaders, among them Pastor Keenan Roberts. Pastor Roberts's particular brand of nuttiness takes the form of what he calls hell houses. A hell house is a place where children are brought, by their parents or their Christian schools, to be scared witless over what might happen to them after they die. Actors play out fearsome tableaus of particular sins, like abortion and homosexuality, with a scarlet-clad devil in gloating attendance. These are a prelude to the pièce de résistance, hell itself, complete with realistic sulphurous smell of burning brimstone and the agonized screams of the forever damned. After watching a rehearsal in which the devil was suitably diabolical in the hammed-up style of a villain of Victorian melodrama, I interviewed Pastor Roberts in the presence of his cast. He told me that the optimum age for a child to visit a hell house is 12. This shocked me somewhat, and I asked him whether it would worry him if a 12-year-old child had nightmares after one of his performances. He replied, presumably honestly,
I would rather for them to understand that hell is a place that they absolutely do not want to go. I would rather reach them with that message at 12 than to not reach them with that message and have them live a life of sin and to never find the Lord Jesus Christ. And if they end up having nightmares as a result of experiencing this, I think there's a higher good that would ultimately be achieved and accomplished in their life than simply having nightmares.
I suppose that if you really and truly believed what Pastor Robert says he believes, you would feel it right to intimidate children too. We cannot write off Pastor Roberts as an extremist wingnut. Like Ted Haggard, he is mainstream in today's America. I'd be surprised if even they would buy into the belief of some of their co-religionists that you can hear the screams of the damned if you listen in on volcanoes, and that the giant tube worms found in hot deep ocean vents are fulfilment of Mark 9:43-4.
And if thy hand offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go into hell, into the fire that never shall be quenched, where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched.
Whatever they believe hell is actually like, all these hellfire enthusiasts seem to share the gloating schadenfreude and complacency of those who know they are among the saved, well conveyed by that foremost among theologians, St. Thomas Aquinas, in Summa Theologica.
That the saints may enjoy their beatitude and the grace of God more abundantly, they are permitted to see the punishment of the damned in hell.
Nice man. Compare Ann Coulter's charming Christian charity.
I defy any of my co-religionists to tell me they do not laugh at the idea of Dawkins burning in hell.
The fear of hellfire can be very real, even among otherwise rational people. After my television documentary on religion, among the many letters I received was this, from an obviously bright and honest woman.
I went to a Catholic school from the age of 5 and was indoctrinated by nuns who wielded straps, sticks and canes. During my teens I read Darwin, and what he said about evolution made such a lot of sense to the logical part of my mind. However, I'd gone through life suffering much conflict and a deep-down fear of hell fire which gets triggered quite frequently. I've had some psychotherapy which has enabled me to work through some of my earlier problems, but can't seem to overcome this deep fear. So the reason I'm writing to you is, would you send me, please, the name and address of the therapist you interviewed on this week's programme who deals with this particular fear?
I was moved by her letter, and, suppressing a momentary and ignoble regret that there is no hell for those nuns to go to, replied that she should trust in her reason as a great gift which she, unlike less fortunate people, obviously possessed. I suggested that the extreme horribleness of hell, as portrayed by priests and nuns, is inflated to compensate for its implausibility. If hell were plausible, it would only have to be moderately unpleasant in order to deter. Given that it is so unlikely to be true, it has to be advertised as very, very scary indeed to balance its implausibility and retain some deterrence value. I also put her in touch with the therapist she mentioned, Jill Mitten, a delightful and deeply sincere woman whom I had interviewed on camera. Jill had herself been raised in a more than usually odious sect called the Exclusive Brethren. Jill Mitten had been brought up to be terrified of hell, had escaped from Christianity as an adult, and now counsels and helps others similarly traumatized in childhood.
If I think back to my childhood, it's one dominated by fear. And it was the fear of disapproval while in the present, but also of eternal damnation. And for a child, images of hellfire and gnashing of teeth are actually very real. They're not metaphorical at all.
I then asked her to spell out what she had actually been told about hell as a child, and her eventual reply was as moving as her expressive face during the long hesitation before she answered.
It's strange, isn't it? After all this time, it still has the power to affect me when you ask me that question. Hell is a fearful place. It's complete rejection by God. It's complete judgment. There is real fire. There is real torment, real torture. And it goes on forever, so there is no respite from it.
She went on to tell me of the support group she runs for escapees from a childhood similar to her own, and she dwelt on how difficult it is for many of them to leave.
The process of leaving is extraordinarily difficult. Ah, you are leaving behind a whole social network, a whole system that you've practically been brought up in. You are leaving behind a belief system that you have held for years. Very often you leave families and friends. You don't really exist anymore for them.
I have already mentioned the American comic actor Julia Sweeney and her dogged and endearingly humorous struggle to find some redeeming features in religion and to rescue the God of her childhood from her growing adult doubts. Eventually her quest ended happily, and she is now an admirable role model for young atheists everywhere. The denouement is perhaps the most moving scene of her show, Letting Go of God. She had tried everything, and then...
As I was walking from my office in my backyard into my house, I realized there was this little teeny-weeny voice whispering in my head. I'm not sure how long it had been there, but it suddenly got just one decibel louder. It whispered, "There is no God." And I tried to ignore it, but it got a teeny bit louder. "There is no God. There is no God. Oh, my God, there is no God." And I shuddered. I felt I was slipping off the raft. And then I thought, but I can't. I don't know if I can not believe in God. I need God. I mean, we have a history. But I don't know how to not believe in God. I don't know how you do it. How do you get up? How do you get through the day? I felt unbalanced. I thought, okay, calm down. Let's just try on the not believing in God glasses for a moment, just for a second. Just put on the no God glasses and take a quick look around and then immediately throw them off. And I put them on and I looked around. I'm embarrassed to report that I initially felt dizzy. I actually had the thought, well, how does the earth stay up in the sky? You mean we're just hurtling through space? That's so vulnerable. I wanted to run out and catch the earth as it fell out of space into my hands. And then I remembered, oh yeah, gravity and angular momentum is going to keep us revolving around the sun for probably a long, long time.
When I saw Letting Go of God in a Los Angeles theatre, I was deeply moved by this scene, especially when Julia went on to tell us of her parents' reaction to a press report of her cure.
My first call from my mother was more of a scream. Atheist? Atheist? My dad called and said, "You have betrayed your family, your school, your city." It was like I'd sold secrets to the Russians. They both said they weren't going to talk to me anymore. My dad said, "I don't even want you to come to my funeral." After I hung up, I thought, just try and stop me.
Part of Julia Sweeney's gift is to make you cry and laugh at the same time.
I think that my parents had been mildly disappointed when I said I didn't believe in God anymore. But being an atheist was another thing altogether.
Dan Barker's Losing Faith in Faith, From Preacher to Atheist, is the story of his gradual conversion from devout fundamentalist minister and zealous travelling preacher to the strong and confident atheist he is today. Significantly, Barker continued to go through the motions of preaching Christianity for a while after he had become an atheist, because it was the only career he knew, and he felt locked into a web of social obligations. He now knows many other American clergymen who are in the same position as he was, but have confided only in him, having read his book. They dare not admit their atheism even to their own families, so terrible is the anticipated reaction. Barker's own story had a happier conclusion. To begin with, his parents were deeply and agonizingly shocked, but they listened to his quiet reasoning and eventually became atheists themselves. Earlier in our televised conversation, Jill Mitten had described this kind of religious upbringing as a form of mental abuse, and I returned to the point as follows. You use the words religious abuse. If you were to compare the abuse of bringing up a child really to believe in hell, how do you think that would compare, in trauma terms, with sexual abuse? She replied,
"Well, that's a very difficult question. I think there are a lot of similarities, actually, because it is about abuse of trust. It is about denying the child the right to feel free and open and able to relate to the world in the normal way. It's a form of denigration. It's a form of denial of the true self, in both cases.
In defense of children. In a lecture in 1997, my colleague, the psychologist Nicholas Humphrey, asked whether Amnesty International, the beneficiary of the lecture series to which he was contributing, should campaign not just against physical torture and imprisonment, but against hurtful or damaging speeches or publications as well. His answer was a resounding no to such censorship in general.
Freedom of speech is too precious a freedom to be meddled with.
But he then went on to shock his liberal self by advocating one important exception, to argue in favour of censorship for the special case of children.
Moral and religious education, and especially the education a child receives at home, where parents are allowed, even expected, to determine for their children what counts as truth and falsehood, right and wrong. Children, I'll argue, have a human right not to have their minds crippled by exposure to other people's bad ideas, no matter who these other people are. Parents, correspondingly, have no God-given license to enculturate their children in whatever ways they personally choose. No right to limit the horizons of their children's knowledge, to bring them up in an atmosphere of dogma and superstition, or to insist they follow the straight and narrow paths of their own faith. In short, children have a right not to have their minds addled by nonsense, and we as a society have a duty to protect them from it. So we should no more allow parents to teach their children to believe, for example, in the literal truth of the Bible, or that the planets rule their lives, than we should allow parents to knock their children's teeth out or lock them in a dungeon.
Of course, such a strong statement needs, and received, much qualification. Isn't it a matter of opinion what is nonsense? Hasn't the apple cart of orthodox science been upset often enough to chasten us into caution? Scientists may think it is nonsense to teach astrology and the literal truth of the Bible, but there are others who think the opposite, and aren't they entitled to teach it to their children? Isn't it just as arrogant to insist that children should be taught science? I thank my own parents for taking the view that children should be taught not so much what to think as how to think. If, having been fairly and properly exposed to all the scientific evidence, they grow up and decide that the Bible is literally true, or that the movements of the planets rule their lives, that is their privilege. The important point is that it is their privilege to decide what they shall think, and not their parents' privilege to impose it by force majeure. And this, of course, is especially important when we reflect that children become the parents of the next generation in a position to pass on whatever indoctrination may have moulded them. Humphrey suggests that, as long as children are young, vulnerable, and in need of protection, truly moral guardianship shows itself in an honest attempt to second-guess what they would choose for themselves if they were old enough to do so. He movingly quotes the example of a young Inca girl whose 500-year-old remains were found frozen in the mountains of Peru in 1995. The anthropologist who discovered her wrote that she had been the victim of a ritual sacrifice. By Humphrey's account, a documentary film about this young ice maiden was shown on American television. Viewers were invited
to marvel at the spiritual commitment of the Inca priests and to share with the girl on her last journey her pride and excitement at having been selected for the signal honour of being sacrificed. The message of the television programme was, in effect, that the practice of human sacrifice was, in its own way, a glorious cultural invention, another jewel in the crown of multiculturalism, if you like.
Humphrey is scandalised, and so am I.
Yet how dare anyone even suggest this? How dare they invite us in our sitting rooms watching television to feel uplifted by contemplating an act of ritual murder, the murder of a dependent child by a group of stupid, puffed-up, superstitious, ignorant old men? How dare they invite us to find good for ourselves in contemplating an immoral action against someone else?
Again, the decent liberal reader may feel a twinge of unease. Immoral by our standards, certainly, and stupid. But what about Inca standards? Surely to the Incas, the sacrifice was a moral act, and far from stupid, sanctioned by all that they held sacred. The little girl was, no doubt, a loyal believer in the religion in which she was brought up. Who are we to use a word like murder, judging Inca priests by our own standards rather than theirs? Perhaps this girl was rapturously happy with her fate. Perhaps she really believed she was going straight to everlasting paradise, warmed by the radiant company of the sun god. Or perhaps, as seems far more likely, she screamed in terror. Humphrey's point, and mine, is that regardless of whether she was a willing victim or not, there is strong reason to suppose that she would not have been willing if she had been in full possession of the facts. For example, suppose she had known that the sun is really a ball of hydrogen, hotter than 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin, converting itself into helium by nuclear fusion, and that it originally formed from a disk of gas out of which the rest of the solar system, including Earth, also condensed. Presumably then, she would not have worshipped it as a god, and this would have altered her perspective on being sacrificed to propitiate it.
The Inca priests cannot be blamed for their ignorance, and it could perhaps be thought harsh to judge them stupid and puffed up. But they can be blamed for foisting their own beliefs on a child too young to decide whether to worship the sun or not. Humphrey's additional point is that today's documentary filmmakers and we, their audience, can be blamed for seeing beauty in that little girl's death, something that enriches our collective culture. The same tendency to glory in the quaintness of ethnic religious habits and to justify cruelties in their name crops up again and again. It is the source of squirming internal conflict in the minds of nice liberal people who, on the one hand, cannot bear suffering and cruelty, but on the other hand have been trained by postmodernists and relativists to respect other cultures no less than their own. Female circumcision is undoubtedly hideously painful. It sabotages sexual pleasure in women. Indeed, this is probably its underlying purpose. And one half of the decent liberal mind wants to abolish the practice. The other half, however, respects ethnic cultures and feels that we should not interfere if they want to mutilate their girls. Point, of course, is that their girls are actually the girls' own girls, and their wishes should not be ignored. Trickier to answer, what if a girl says she wants to be circumcised? But would she, with the hindsight of a fully informed adult, wish that it had never happened? Humphrey makes the point that no adult woman who has somehow missed out on circumcision as a child volunteers for the operation later in life. It is a regular practice in Britain today. A senior schools inspector tells of London girls in 2006 being sent to an uncle in Bradford to be circumcised. Authorities turn a blind eye for fear of being thought racist in the community.
After a discussion of the Amish and their right to bring up their own children in their own way, Humphrey is scathing about our enthusiasm as a society for
maintaining cultural diversity. All right, you may want to say, so it's tough on a child of the Amish or the Hasidim or the Gypsies to be shaped up by their parents in the ways they are. But at least the result is that these fascinating cultural traditions continue. Would not our whole civilization be impoverished if they were to go? It's a shame, maybe, when individuals have to be sacrificed to maintain such diversity, but there it is. It's the price we pay as a society. Except I would feel bound to remind you, we do not pay it. They do.
The issue came to public attention in 1972 when the US Supreme Court ruled in favour of the right of Amish parents to withdraw their children from school on religious grounds. The Amish people live in closed communities in various parts of the United States, mostly speaking an archaic dialect of German called Pennsylvania Dutch and eschewing, to varying extents, electricity, internal combustion engines, buttons, and other manifestations of modern life. There is indeed something attractively quaint about an island of 17th century life as a spectacle for today's eyes. Isn't it worth preserving for the sake of the enrichment of human diversity? And the only way to preserve it is to allow the Amish to educate their own children in their own way and to protect them from the corrupting influence of modernity. But, we surely want to ask, shouldn't the children themselves have some say in the matter? There is something breathtakingly condescending, as well as inhumane, about the sacrificing of anyone, especially children, on the altar of diversity and the virtue of preserving a variety of religious traditions. The rest of us are happy with our cars and computers, our vaccines and antibiotics, but you quaint little people with your bonnets and breeches, your horse buggies, your archaic dialect and your earth closet privies, you enrich our lives. Of course you must be allowed to trap your children with you in your 17th century time warp. Otherwise something irretrievable would be lost to us, a part of the wonderful diversity of human culture. A small part of me can see something in this, but the larger part is made to feel very queasy indeed. An educational scandal. The Prime Minister of my country, Tony Blair, invoked diversity when challenged in the House of Commons by Jenny Tong, MP, to justify government subsidy of a school in the northeast of England that, almost uniquely in Britain, teaches literal biblical creationism. Mr. Blair replied that it would be unfortunate if concerns about that issue were to interfere with our getting as diverse a school system as we properly can. The school in question, Emmanuel College in Gateshead, is one of the city academies set up in a proud initiative of the Blair government. Rich benefactors are encouraged to put up a relatively small sum of money, £2 million in the case of Emmanuel, which buys a much larger sum of government money, £20 million for this school, plus running costs and salaries in perpetuity, and also buys the benefactor the right to control the ethos of the school, the appointment of a majority of the school governors, the policy for exclusion or inclusion of pupils, and much else. Emmanuel's 10% benefactor is Sir Peter Vardy, a wealthy car salesman with a creditable desire to give today's children the education he wishes he had had, and a less creditable desire to imprint his own personal religious convictions upon them. H. L. Mencken was prophetic when he wrote,
"Deep within the heart of every evangelist lies the wreck of a car salesman."
Vardy has unfortunately become embroiled with a clique of American-inspired fundamentalist teachers led by Nigel McCoyd, sometime headmaster of Emmanuel and now director of a whole consortium of Vardy schools. The level of McCoyd's scientific understanding can be judged from his belief that the world is less than 10,000 years old, and also from the following quotation.
"But to think that we just evolved from a bang, that we used to be monkeys, that seems unbelievable when you look at the complexity of the human body. If you tell children there is no purpose to their life, that they are just a chemical mutation, that doesn't build self-esteem."
No scientist has ever suggested that a child is a chemical mutation. The use of the phrase in such a context is illiterate nonsense. Well, science is not Mr. McCoyd's subject, so we should, in fairness, turn to his head of science, Stephen Layfield, instead. On the 21st of September 2001, Mr. Layfield gave a lecture at Emmanuel College on The Teaching of Science, a Biblical Perspective. The text of the lecture was posted on a Christian website, but you won't find it there now. The Christian Institute removed the lecture the very day after I had called attention to it in an article in the Daily Telegraph. It is hard, however, to delete something permanently from the World Wide Web. Search engines achieve their speed partly by keeping caches of information, and these inevitably persist for a while, even after the originals have been deleted. An alert British journalist, Andrew Brown, the Independent's first religious affairs correspondent, promptly located the Layfield lecture, downloaded it from the Google cache, and posted it, safe from deletion, on his own website. Incidentally, when a curious reader wrote to Emmanuel College to ask why the lecture had been removed from the website, he received the following disingenuous reply from the school, again recorded by Andrew Brown.
"Emmanuel College has been at the centre of a debate regarding the teaching of creation in schools. At a practical level, Emmanuel College has had a huge number of press calls. This has involved a considerable amount of time for the principal and senior directors of the college. All of these people have other jobs to do. In order to assist, we have temporarily removed a lecture by Stephen Layfield from our website."
Of course, the school officials may well have been too busy to explain to journalists their stance on teaching creationism. But why then remove from their website the text of a lecture that does precisely that, and to which they could have referred the journalists, thereby saving themselves a great deal of time. No, they removed their head of science's lecture because they recognized that they had something to hide. The following paragraph is from the beginning of his lecture.
Let us state, then, right from the start, that we reject the notion popularized, perhaps inadvertently, by Francis Bacon in the 17th century, that there are two books, i.e. the Book of Nature and the Scriptures, which may be mined independently for truth. Rather, we stand firm upon the bare proposition that God has spoken authoritatively and inerrantly in the pages of Holy Scripture. However fragile, old-fashioned, or naive this assertion may ostensibly appear, especially to an unbelieving, TV-drunk modern culture, we can be sure that it is as robust a foundation as it is possible to lay down and build upon.
You have to keep pinching yourself. You are not dreaming. This is not some preacher in a tent in Alabama, but the head of science at a school into which the British government is pouring money, and which is Tony Blair's pride and joy. A devout Christian himself, Mr. Blair in 2004, performed the ceremonial opening of one of the later additions to the Vardy fleet of schools. Diversity may be a virtue, but this is diversity gone mad. Layfield proceeds to itemize the comparison between science and scripture, concluding in every case where there seems to be a conflict that scripture is to be preferred. Noting that earth science is now included in the national curriculum, Layfield says,
It would seem particularly prudent for all those who deliver this aspect of the course to familiarise themselves with the flood geology papers of Whitcomb and Morris.
Yes, flood geology means what you think it means. We're talking Noah's Ark here. Noah's Ark, when the children could be learning the spine-tingling fact that Africa and South America were once joined and have drawn apart at the speed with which fingernails grow. Layfield's teaching that the scriptures provide a literal account of geological history would make any reputable theologian wince. My friend Richard Harris, Bishop of Oxford, and I wrote a joint letter to Tony Blair, and we got it signed by 8 bishops and 9 senior scientists. The 9 scientists included the then President of the Royal Society, previously Tony Blair's chief scientific adviser, both the biological and physical secretaries of the Royal Society, the Astronomer Royal, now President of the Royal Society, the Director of the Natural History Museum, and Sir David Attenborough, perhaps the most respected man in England. The bishops included 1 Roman Catholic and 7 Anglican bishops, senior religious leaders from all around England. We received a perfunctory and inadequate reply from the Prime Minister's office, referring to the school's good examination results and its good report from the official school's inspection agency, Ofsted. It apparently didn't occur to Mr. Blair that if the Ofsted inspectors give a rave report to a school whose head of science teaches that the entire universe began after the domestication of the dog, there just might be something a teeny-weeny bit wrong with the standards of the inspectorate. Perhaps the most disturbing section of Stephen Layfield's lecture is his concluding What Can Be Done, where he considers the tactics to be employed by those teachers wishing to introduce fundamentalist Christianity into the science classroom. For example, he urges science teachers to
note every occasion when an evolutionary old earth paradigm, millions or billions of years, is explicitly mentioned or implied by a textbook, examination question or visitor, and courteously point out the fallibility of the statement. Wherever possible, we must give the alternative, always better, biblical explanation of the same data. We shall look at a few examples from each of physics, chemistry and biology in due course.
The rest of Layfield's lecture is nothing less than a propaganda manual, a resource for religious teachers of biology, chemistry and physics who wish, while remaining just inside the guidelines of the national curriculum, to subvert evidence-based science education and replace it with biblical scripture. Headmaster McQuaid offered a defence of what he clearly saw as his school's open-mindedness, which is remarkable for its patronising complacency.
The best example I can give of what it is like here is a sixth-form philosophy lecture I was giving. Shaquille was sitting there, and he says, The Quran is correct and true. And Claire over here says, No, the Bible is true. So we talked about the similarities between what they say and the places where they disagree. And we agreed that they could not both be true. And eventually I said, "Sorry, Shaquille, you are wrong. It is the Bible that is true." And he said, "Sorry, Mr. McQuaid, you are wrong. It is the Quran." And they went on to lunch and carried on discussing it there. That's what we want. We want children to know why it is they believe what they believe and to defend it.
What a charming picture. Shaquille and Claire went to lunch together, vigorously arguing their cases and defending their incompatible beliefs. But is it really so charming? Isn't it actually rather a deplorable picture that Mr. McQuaid has painted? Upon what, after all, did Shaquille and Claire base their argument? What cogent evidence was each one able to bring to bear in their vigorous and constructive debate? Claire and Shaquille each simply asserted that her or his holy book was superior, and that was that. That is apparently all they said, and that indeed is all you can say when you've been taught that truth comes from scripture rather than from evidence. Claire and Shaquille and their fellows were not being educated. They were being let down by their school, and their school principal was abusing not their bodies, but their minds.
Consciousness raising again. And now here's another charming picture. At Christmas time one year, the daily newspaper The Independent was looking for a seasonal image and found a heartwarmingly ecumenical one at a school nativity play. The three wise men were played by, as the caption glowingly said, Shadbreet, a Sikh, Musharraf, a Muslim, and Adele, a Christian, all aged 4.
Charming. Heartwarming. No, it is not. It is neither. It is grotesque. How could any decent person think it right to label 4-year-old children with the cosmic and theological opinions of their parents? To see this, imagine an identical photograph with the caption changed as follows.
Shadbreet, a Keynesian, Musharraf, a monetarist, and Adele, a Marxist. All aged 4.
Wouldn't this be a candidate for irate letters of protest? It certainly should be. Yet, because of the weirdly privileged status of religion, not a squeak was heard, nor is it ever heard on any similar occasion. Just imagine the outcry if the caption had read,
Shadbreet, an atheist, Musharraf, an agnostic, and Adele, a secular humanist. All aged 4.
Mightn't the parents actually be investigated to see if they were fit to bring up children? In an earlier chapter, I generalised the theme of consciousness raising, starting with the achievement of feminists in making us flinch when we hear a phrase like men of goodwill instead of people of goodwill. Here I want to raise consciousness in another way. I think we should all wince when we hear a small child being labelled as belonging to some particular religion or another. Small children are too young to decide their views on the origins of the cosmos, of life, and of morals. The very sound of the phrase Christian child or Muslim child should grate like fingernails on a blackboard. Here is a report dated 3rd of September 2001 from the Irish radio station KPFT-FM.
Catholic schoolgirls faced protests from loyalists as they attempted to enter the Holy Cross Girls' Primary School on the Ardoyne Road in North Belfast. Royal Ulster Constabulary, RUC, officers and British Army, BA, soldiers had to clear the protesters who were attempting to blockade the school. Crash barriers were erected to allow the children to get through the protest to the school. Loyalists jeered and shouted sectarian abuse as the children, some as young as 4 years of age, were escorted by the parents into the school. As children and parents entered the front gate of the school, loyalists threw bottles and stones.
Naturally, any decent person will wince at the ordeal of these unfortunate schoolgirls. I am trying to encourage us to wince, too, at the very idea of labelling them Catholic schoolgirls at all. Loyalists, as I pointed out in Chapter 1, is the mealy-mouthed Northern Ireland euphemism for Protestants, just as nationalists is the euphemism for Catholics. People who do not hesitate to brand children Catholics or Protestants stop short of applying those same religious labels far more appropriately to adult terrorists and mobs.
Our society, including the non-religious sector, has accepted the preposterous idea that it is normal and right to indoctrinate tiny children in the religion of their parents and to slap religious labels on them. Catholic child, Protestant child, Jewish child, Muslim child, etc., although no other comparable labels. No conservative children, no liberal children, no Republican children, no Democrat children. Please, please raise your consciousness about this, and raise the roof whenever you hear it happening. A child is not a Christian child, not a Muslim child, but a child of Christian parents, or a child of Muslim parents. This latter nomenclature, by the way, would be an excellent piece of consciousness raising for the children themselves. A child who is told she is a child of Muslim parents will immediately realize that religion is something for her to choose or reject when she becomes old enough to do so.
A good case can indeed be made for the educational benefits of teaching comparative religion. Certainly my own doubts were first aroused at the age of about 9 by the lesson, which came not from school but from my parents, that the Christian religion in which I was brought up was only one of many mutually incompatible belief systems. Religious apologists themselves realize this, and it often frightens them. After that nativity play story in The Independent, not a single letter to the editor complained of the religious labeling of the four-year-olds. The only negative letter came from the Campaign for Real Education, whose spokesman, Nick Seaton, said multi-faith religious education was extremely dangerous because
children these days are taught that all religions are of equal worth, which means that their own has no special value.
Yes, indeed, that is exactly what it means. Well might this spokesman worry. On another occasion, the same individual said,
to present all faiths as equally valid is wrong. Everybody is entitled to think their faith is superior to others, be they Hindus, Jews, Muslims, or Christians. Otherwise, what's the point in having faith?
What, indeed? And what transparent nonsense this is. These faiths are mutually incompatible, otherwise what is the point of thinking your faith superior? Most of them, therefore, cannot be superior to others. Let children learn about different faiths, let them notice their incompatibility, and let them draw their own conclusions about the consequences of that incompatibility. As for whether any are valid, let them make up their own minds when they are old enough to do so. Religious education as a part of literary culture. I must admit that even I am a little taken aback at the biblical ignorance commonly displayed by people educated in more recent decades than I was. Or maybe it isn't a decade thing. As long ago as 1954, according to Robert Hind in his thoughtful book Why Gods Persist, a Gallup poll in the United States of America found the following. 3/4 of Catholics and Protestants could not name a single Old Testament prophet. More than 2/3 didn't know who preached the Sermon on the Mount. A substantial number thought that Moses was one of Jesus's 12 apostles. That, to repeat, was in the United States, which is dramatically more religious than other parts of the developed world. The King James Bible of 1611, the Authorized Version, includes passages of outstanding literary merit in its own right, for example, the Song of Songs, and the sublime Ecclesiastes, which I am told is pretty good in the original Hebrew too. But the main reason the English Bible needs to be part of our education is that it is a major source book for literary culture. The same applies to the legends of the Greek and Roman gods, and we learn about them without being asked to believe in them. Surely ignorance of the Bible is bound to impoverish one's appreciation of English literature. And not just solemn and serious literature. The following rhyme by Lord Justice Bowen is ingeniously witty.
The rain it raineth on the just, and also on the unjust, fella, but chiefly on the just, because the unjust hath the just's umbrella.
But the enjoyment is muffled if you can't take the allusion to Matthew 5:45.
For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust.
And the fine point of Eliza Doolittle's fantasy in My Fair Lady would escape anybody ignorant of John the Baptist's end.
Thanks a lot, King, says I, in a manner well-bred, but all I want is Henry Higgins Ed.
P.G. Wodehouse is, for my money, the greatest writer of light comedy in English. The Woodhouse canon is rich in biblical allusions. Listen to Bertie Wooster's evocation of what it is like to wake up with a bad hangover.
I'd been dreaming that some bounder was driving spikes through my head, not just ordinary spikes as used by Jael, the wife of Heber, but red-hot ones.
Bertie himself was immensely proud of his only scholastic achievement, the prize he once earned for scripture knowledge.
What is true of comic writing in English is more obviously true of serious literature. Nasib Shaheen's tally of more than 1,300 biblical references in Shakespeare's works is widely cited and very believable. The Bible Literacy Report, published in Fairfax, Virginia, admittedly financed by the infamous Templeton Foundation, provides many examples and cites overwhelming agreement by teachers of English literature that biblical literacy is essential to full appreciation of their subject. Doubtless the equivalent is true of French, German, Russian, Italian, Spanish, and other great European literatures. And for speakers of Arabic and Indian languages, knowledge of the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita is presumably just as essential for full appreciation of their literary heritage. Finally, to round off the list, you can't appreciate Wagner, whose music, as has been wittily said, is better than it sounds, without knowing your way around the Norse gods.
Let me not labour the point. I've probably said enough to convince at least my older readers that an atheistic worldview provides no justification for cutting the Bible and other sacred books out of our education. And of course we can retain a sentimental loyalty to the cultural and literary traditions of, say, Judaism, Anglicanism, or Islam, and even participate in religious rituals such as marriages and funerals, without buying into the supernatural beliefs that historically went along with those traditions. We can give up belief in God while not losing touch with a treasured heritage.